Dogs, Earth Explorers, welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Did you know you have existed for many thousands of years? The thought of reincarnation escapes most people, as it did me until I read this book. Your Never-Ending Life is the first in the Universal Learning series from Sandy Andrew. Search your higher mind, find your soulmate, and know that you are never alone in this world. The treasures of the eternities are yours, and your first step is to read the book. Click the banner for Your Never-Ending Life by Sandy Andrew at X Squared Radio and order the book today. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and the Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysms? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in this series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com. Get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version.
Central Idaho, amidst the snow and the mountains. The solar wind tonight is 319 kilometers per second and still no sunspots. That's more than 300 days without a major solar flare and nearly 5 months without a significant sunspot. There were two sunspot precursors last week from solar cycle 24, but scientists are baffled as to why the sun is a no-show. The Geminid meteor showers peak out tonight, but much of the country is covered in snowing clouds, so many of you, will not get to see them. This last full moon was the closest and brightest of the year, called a perigee moon. If you were looking up through the light clouds at the full moon, you may have even seen a moonbow. But if you missed it, don't worry, because the first full moon of January will be the brightest of 2009. If you want to do some moon bathing, that will be the moon from which you'll get the deepest tan. This just in from The Hague. European governments on November 26th approved about 10 billion euros, about $13 billion, in new financing for the 18-nation European Space Agency in the coming years, with major new funding for Earth observation and meteorological satellites, early work on a more powerful version of the Ariane 5 rocket, and an increase in annual spending on space science. It's about time the world started spending their money on something besides weapons systems. The U.S. Air Force Space and Missile Systems Center may forego competition and award a sole source contract for a new missile warning system it is now calling the Infrared Augmentation Satellite, according to the Air Force. The missile defense system is designed to alert and trigger anti-missile systems to protect America. It also has been reported to strengthen space-based weapons for defense against other trespassers above the atmosphere of Earth. Last week on X Squared Radio, our guest was Dr. Gary Schwartz, the author of The Afterlife Experiment and The God Experiments. The interview was awesome, with some groundbreaking information on the ability to communicate between dimensions. Go back and listen to it by subscribing to the archives at x2-radio.com. Tonight, our guest is the author of the book Unearthing Ancient America. He is the editor-in-chief of Ancient American Magazine and the author of more than 20 books. Please welcome with me Frank Joseph. How are you, Frank?
I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for letting me on.
Oh, this is going to be great. You know, X Squared Radio is where the past meets the future. It's, you know, the way most people experience the past is through history, like in textbooks or specials on the History Channel. But I have to ask you, who writes the history?
Well, you'll notice the subtitle of my book is relates to explorers and conquerors and scoundrels. And the scoundrels in the book are today's archaeologists and teachers who have told us a skewered view of the past, a politically correct view that has cut us off from the truth and has cut us off from our prehistoric roots. And the purpose of publishing a book like Uncovering Ancient America is to disclose some of these facts. Some of them have been known for over 100 years, but are nonetheless suppressed. Others are brand new pieces of information that prove, don't theorize, provide hard evidence that there were overseas visitors to our continent, not hundreds of years before Columbus, but thousands, and that the prehistory of our country is made up of this impact from other parts of the world.
Well, I for one, find that fascinating. You know, I guess we'll show tonight that history shows us that those who wrote the history we study as truth had a vested interest in their version of the facts, and that the current establishment, educational systems, well, they just refuse to revise that version despite the discovery of new evidence. I know you've been, you know, frustrated with this because I noticed that you've worked tirelessly for many years and obviously have a passion for discovery. But what we're going to discuss tonight will most likely be new information for most of our readers. How would you advise them, our listeners, if we go back and start revising what we've been taught in our high schools and colleges about who settled America and who was here first?
Well, I think that what we need to do is, first of all, keep an open mind and not be like the mainstream educators and promoters of the Columbus myth into accepting only their version of the past. And that I think that if we keep that open mind, we'll see that Columbus did achieve a great feat of adventure. However, he was not the first discoverer of America. He was the last discoverer of America. And it's understandable why this information has been suppressed, because he had been preceded by five centuries of a dark age. And he was a Renaissance man. Renaissance, of course, means new birth, rebirth. And that's because Western civilization had fallen into the pits for 500 years. And all of the great achievements, most of the great achievements of the previous thousands of years, had been forgotten or intentionally destroyed when, for example, the Library of Alexandria was torched by people who found all that information in there demonic and consigned it to the flames of hell. Well, by doing that, all the knowledge and all the sea routes and everything else that once linked the Near East and Western Europe to the Americas was lost. And so Columbus had to start over from scratch, as it were. But I think to answer your question, what we need to have, as I said, is an open mind and to consider some of the fabulous information that has come out. And that is the great fun that I had in putting this book together. I did not write this book. I have a couple of articles in there. But I had the opportunity of collecting the finest articles, I thought, in my opinion, the finest articles from the last 15 years of Ancient American Magazine. And these articles, they had a few criteria that I set for them. One, very little theories, very little. I wanted hard evidence. I wanted proof, because people ask us about this. Well, you say the Vikings were here before Columbus and the Phoenicians and the Egyptians. What proof do you have? So I figured, okay, we're going to lay it on the table in this book. We're not going to talk about theory so much. We're just going to present the evidence. I also wanted to have short little articles. I wanted almost bulleted little things. So you can pick this book up anywhere. You don't have to read it from cover to cover. You can start anywhere, and you can learn about the Vikings or the Phoenicians or any of these other great people that impacted our continent. And it's a very widespread. And there's also some mysteries in there. We have no idea where some of these objects or sites came from, like Florida's Stonehenge, for example, that was found in Miami Beach, Florida, about 10 years ago, almost exactly 10 years ago, when an apartment building was being constructed. And they cleared the land for the foundation of this new apartment building, and they found a very strange object buried about 20 feet underground. That was pretty deep, considering that it was a man-made object. And it is a beautiful limestone disc, about 18 feet in diameter, beautifully cut limestone, polished limestone, and the perimeter of this disc is formed of 24 oval slots. Not far, very close, as a matter of fact, hardly more than a couple of yards from this disc, were found some of the columns, pillars, that were fitted at one time into these slots. The number 24 is highly significant astronomically. It's a multiple of course. Well, there's 24 hours in our day. It's a cosmic number. And it was found by the archaeologists that if you had set up this disc originally, the way it was originally set up and put its columns in place, they would have funneled in a great deal of astronomical information. So it's a sophisticated little astronomical computer, similar to, fundamentally, the much larger Stonehenge in Britain. Who made this? What culture is responsible for this great object? Nobody knows. First, they tried to hook it up with the local Indian tribes, and the Indian tribes said, we don't know anything about it. We have no traditions of that whatsoever. We do know that the Indians in Florida, prehistoric Indians, were hunter-gatherers. They were not interested in astronomy. They never built anything in stone of this sophistication. They were people on the move. They lived very close to nature. This represents a form of technology, astronomical technology, and architecture that is more common to the British Isles and even places like Egypt. And it's definitely, no doubt about it, a monument to someone from some other part of the world who created this thing a long time ago. That's only a small fraction, not even the tip of the iceberg of the evidence that indicates that America was a melting pot long before the Statue of Liberty was set up.
Well, this item down in Florida, this Florida Stonehenge, did they find any of the structure that actually fits down in these holes that were machined?
Yes, they did. It was made of the pillars. Pillar is the wrong word to describe them because they're rather rounded rectangular columns, if you want to call them that. They're not particularly tall. The object, or rather the site itself, is too small for a temple. However, it could have accommodated one or two or three individuals in the center who could have used these columns as gun sights against celestial phenomena. They're called gnomon. So you arrange the position of the column in the location where a constellation or the moon, phase of the moon, or a solstice sunrise will take place, and that information will be revealed in the shadows that are cast across the floor of this beautiful limestone disc.
So now the stone that they actually cut these column bases into, what kind of stone was it?
It's beautiful limestone, very high quality limestone.
What date do they expect, or did they imagine that this was constructed in?
Well, now this was the difficulty. They found contrary evidence. They found some strange items that had been buried with this, appear to have been buried. No bodies, no human remains, but they did find the remains of a ritually laid out dolphin, and which is a cultural anomaly. It appears that the Native Americans in Florida never worshipped the dolphin or used it as a cult object, and here, along with this limestone disc, was this perfectly preserved dolphin skeleton, and the dolphin skeleton itself was in very poor condition, and it was dated back to probably about 800 A.D. However, the depth at which the disc itself was found, 20 or a little over 20 feet, indicates that of all the deposition that was necessary to bury it like that, and it wasn't intentionally buried, it was a natural burying process, would have taken far longer than only about 1,200 years ago. So the consensus is that the building itself, this little structure itself, was on dry land overlooking the ocean anywhere between about 2,500 years ago and about 3,000 years ago. Now, the Native Americans in that area, they were never interested in celestial architecture of this kind. So the general consensus now is that this stone building was used by someone about probably between, say, 500 or 1,000 years before Christ.
Well, now that's significant. I mean, that wouldn't just be a small, tribe of people sitting in the middle of Florida. That would indicate to me that a fairly major civilization, at least a major city, was there, and they had some kind of edifice constructed, some kind of centrally located edifice for either, religious purposes or perhaps even worshiping nature if they were involved with dolphins.
Well, I kind of disagree with you. It's speculation. Of course, you may be 100% right. There's no real information on that. However, the position of the little temple or the shrine, which would have been very close to the seashore at that time, indicates that it might have been part of a smaller colony of people from the ancient old world who used the astronomical information that was being calibrated to help in their voyages, their navigation. And the dolphin seems to indicate also a sea-oriented people. The dolphin, for example, was never worshipped or used as a cult object in the Americas. However, it was used as a cult object in ancient Greece. They were known as Nereids. The Nereids, you're probably familiar with this image of a boy on a dolphin, riding a dolphin. And that's an old Greek concept, a religious concept of showing the union, the metaphysical union, the spiritual union between human beings and animals. And the Nereids were these dolphins that were considered sacred. As a matter of fact, it was a capital offense in ancient Greece to kill a dolphin because they were sacred to the god Apollo, and they were considered very close to being human beings. The Greeks had some very interesting dolphin research, and here we see the dolphin put in a religious context, it would appear, on the shores of Florida, the Atlantic shores of Florida, at this magnificent little shrine. However, you may be right after all, because this is by no means the only such structure that has been found in Florida. There's an immense irrigation system that was found on the other side of Florida, the exact opposite, on the western side of Florida. There's a gigantic shell mound in the shape of an octopus, which can only be seen from the air outside of Tampa. These are all the earmarks, the ruins of obviously some high culture that had nothing to do with Native Americans, that suggests contacts from elsewhere.
Wow. I mean, that, well, besides the fact that they may not have had, or at least we don't suspect it, it came from an age where people had advanced tooling to be able to cut down into limestone that way.
Well, they may have advanced. They may have had advanced tooling. There's a very brilliant researcher by the name of Christopher Dunn, who's worked a lot on the ancient tooling of the Egyptians and how incredibly sophisticated their work was. And if you look at the slot, as I did, I got a chance to examine the Florida disc a few years ago, and they're not crudely cut into the limestone at all. They're very uniform. It looks as though it could have been modern tools. It's remarkably well done. And the floor itself appears to have been, and the archaeologists will tell you this, polished with some kind of a mixture of probably clay and diamond dust to give it this wonderful, bright sheen. So obviously it was a very special place to whoever built it. This story, though, of the Florida Stonehenge is kind of an anomaly in our book, because we're not able to place the identity of the people who built and used this. The other objects, though, that we discuss and other places, we pretty well have nailed down just who these people were and when they were here.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about one of the other anomalies first. Let's talk about, you mentioned an Egyptian statue being found in Illinois.
Yes.
There's a statue. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that. Does it look Egyptian? Do we know pretty much when it was made?
Yes, it's a great little find that was made about 70 years ago in Libertyville, Illinois. That's about 40 miles, almost due north of the city of Chicago. And it was removed by just a kind of a treasure hunter or just a fellow that collected things in the area when he was in his 20s. And he broke into an Indian mound. Of course, this is in the days before protection for things like that, back in the 1920s or early 30s, I guess. And there, of course, are numerous Indian mounds all over northern Illinois. And sometimes they do contain grave goods, simple things like pipes and so on. Sometimes a human skull you'll find. But in this particular mound, on the shores of a very small lake, which has actually since been dried up and built over by developers, but he went into this Indian mound and he removed it, this beautiful little statuette, which is identifiably Egyptian. It's beautifully made. Some people have said, well, it's impossible, a little Egyptian statuette in Illinois, that couldn't possibly be authentic. It's got to be a fake. But the workmanship of this little object is so high. I've been to Egypt several times, and you can buy reproductions over there. They're nowhere near as good as this one. This is like a museum piece. If it's a reproduction, it's a museum piece reproduction. And what we found out in studying this little object is that it was known as an ushabti. Ushabti is ancient Egyptian for a kind of a little statue in which the high priests would infuse a kind of magic, I guess they would call it, for the deceased, so that when a wealthy person, or most likely royalty, was interred in their tomb, they were given a number, their bodies were surrounded by a number of these little statuettes called ushabti, and in the afterlife, they would come to life themselves, and they would act as servants, it was believed, to the spirit of the deceased. This is part of Egyptian grave goods and funeral practices. And this particular ushabti reveals in its own designs and in the way that it has a kind of a body stocking on. And that body stocking dates itself very specifically to a period of time in which there was a pharaoh by the name of Necho. N-E-K-A-U, Neckau or Neckau. And Neckau was interesting because he launched the first known circumnavigation of the continent of Africa about 600 B.C. This navigation was forgotten and not revived until the Portuguese got going many hundreds of years later. But we do know that Neckau launched this expedition of Phoenician ships, Phoenician and mixed crews of Phoenicians and Egyptians. So it's conceivable, now this we speculate now, that since this little Ushabti found in Illinois is dated to 600 B.C. by its internal evidence, by its clothing, its body stocking, just when this kind of Ushabti was made, we speculate that either one of Neckau's ships was blown across the Atlantic when they were trying to make their circumnavigation of Africa, or else it was part an adjunct, part of their actual expedition to go further. Who knows? But it does fit up. The two time periods match pretty well. It's not probable that the Egyptians came to Illinois. More likely, they landed along the eastern seaboard or the Gulf Coast of the United States, and that this Ushabti was used as a trade good with Native Americans. And that's how it found its way into a Native American Indian mound that was used as a burial mound. Some of the practices associated with Ushabti may have been conveyed to the Native Americans, and that's how it got to be in Illinois. That's speculation, but it's definitely the object is authentic, and it does suggest one way or another that ancient Egyptians did touch the shores of America 600 years before Christ.
Now, with this particular little Ushabti, was there a cartouche associated with this, or was this kind of an open-ended Ushabti that might have been, you know, given out as the king, as kind of a vicarious protector for his explorers?
Yeah, it's difficult to say exactly what the purpose of the Ushabti was inside the mound. As far as we are able to understand, there was nothing else found inside the mound. That doesn't mean there wasn't anything in there to begin with. There could have been organic materials that have since disappeared, since rotted away. No, the little Ushabti was the only thing that was found inside this one particular burial mound.
Well, it's clear the Indians valued it as a treasure and ostensibly knew what the purpose of it was because they put it in the burial mound.
Right. So it's a very important object. And we were able to reproduce a pretty good photograph of it in the book, and I think that you can see that it's just too exquisitely made for somebody to have faked up and said, oh, you know, we... Nobody, by the way, has tried to make any money off of this find or to promote themselves in any particular way. The fellow that found it, as a matter of fact, he passed away without showing it to many people at all. It was only through his widow that we came into contact with this object. Never been discussed before, never been photographed before.
Now, if it was a trade item, I guess one of the things that comes to my mind, if it made its way into the country in the Gulf and then was, you know, traded from hand to hand or tribe to tribe all the way up the Mississippi to Illinois, there doesn't seem to be any record of Indians copying it or beginning to adopt its appearance in their culture. And we know, you know, that the custom was to place one of these Ushabtis at a grave or a tomb.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think it's possible that the Egyptians made their way up to Illinois and traded it up there? Or do you think it's possible it could have survived for 2,000 miles?
However, it's particularly interesting that this area in northern Illinois is on the water route to a place that the Egyptians would have been extremely interested in, and this is the great mining enterprise, the ancient copper mining enterprise that took place in the Upper Great Lakes region of Michigan and Wisconsin. This is another tremendously important fact which has been suppressed by mainstream archaeologists for well over 100 years, and they've known about it since the mid-1800s, and that is that between 5,000 B.C., that's an awfully long time ago, between 5,000 B.C. and 3,000 B.C., somebody opened up a prodigious modern mining enterprise all along the Kewaunee Peninsula of Upper Michigan, and they removed whoever these miners were, they removed a conservative amount of 250 billion pounds of the world's highest grade copper. And they removed this copper in sophisticated mining techniques. We know because not only are some of their pit mines still in existence, more than some, hundreds of their pit mines still exist, but also some of their machines. These were not machines that you plug into a wall socket, but they were nonetheless machines. They were, one of them was a crib work that was able to lift from a pit mine. The pit mine, of course, is a vertical shaft sunk into the solid rock. They were able to do that. They were able to dig down to over 60 feet of solid rock. And this machine that was found at the base of one of these pit mines could support a 6-ton nugget of copper and just could be levered straight up to the top. And these copper miners left not a trace of their copper behind. All that copper, that 250 billion pounds of the world's highest grade copper, vanished. At the same time, while this was going on in North America, the Great Bronze Age erupted in Europe, in Western Europe, and in the Near East. And that's interesting because the Near Easterners and the Western Europeans did not have access to natural large amounts of high-grade copper, and you need copper to make bronze. Bronze was the nuclear fission of its age, in other words, about 5,000 years ago. So there seems to be no doubt whatsoever, and I've just given you the thumbnail sketch of this, that Near Easterners and Europeans were sailing across the North Atlantic and excavated, were the miners. They were the people who excavated this incredible amount of high-grade copper to fuel their Bronze Age. Quarter of a million pounds of copper removed, that's an ultra-conservative amount. It's now believed that it was several times that amount that was removed.
Well, I do have some questions about this, because I got to approach this from an engineer's standpoint right now.
Sure.
I'm thinking about how challenging it would have been to locate the richest copper deposit on the planet.
No
challenge. We're not talking about something that's along the coast. We're talking about something that's pretty much geographically in the center of the United States, what we now know as the United States. And the peoples that would have financed bringing over the resources to mine that and get it back over there didn't even know this part of the world existed, at least according to our modern history books. So, you know, to me, it would have taken several hundred years of exploration to even find the copper if they were, you know, walking along the ground or sailing up and down rivers and core drilling here and there. It would seem to me the only way to find a deposit that rich, that far back, or even on our planet, would be from the air, don't you think?
No, not at all. It'd be extremely easy to find it. Now, this is how they were able to do it. This is supposition, but it's very obvious supposition. The Native Americans never mined copper. They were not copper miners. They did have much later in historic times. They did have some gold mines. Mostly, this was technology and so on that they did to satisfy white man's greed. But in ancient times, a people known as the Paleo Indians, these are very, very far back in the history, prehistory of Native Americans, they never mined copper. However, they picked up something called float copper, and these were small nodules of copper which were left behind as trace elements from the retreating glacier. And when the Native Americans picked up these shiny pieces of copper, they annealed it. They didn't heat it or smelt it. They just cold hammered it. That's what annealing is. And they beat it into shapes and so on. And all this copper came from the Kewanee Peninsula, no place else. It was left all over the place, this copper. And the Native Americans were very great, very skillful in using the profuse waterways that connected many parts of North America, far more back then than today. Hydrologists know that the river systems of North America 5,000 and more years ago were far more navigable than they have ever been since, probably as a last gasp of the Ice Age. Well, whatever. And the Native Americans used this annealed copper that they found, the float copper, to make all kinds of ornaments. So almost every tribe in the United States, North America, had some kind of copper ornament. So let's say there are these voyagers, for one reason or another, these sailors that travel from Western Europe or the Near East to the shores of North America. And we know for a fact, and even archaeologists, mainstream archaeologists will agree with this, that there were Europeans known as the Red Paint People who sailed along the coasts of New England. This is a great new controversy coming out, but many mainstream archaeologists know that this is a fact. And so people visiting North America met with the Indians and said, hey, that's a pretty nice shiny trinket you got on there, a necklace. Boy, look, that's great copper. Where'd you get that? Oh, well, this is where we got it. What have you got to trade? Well, look at these nice furs or whatever. I think that's all it took. That's supposition immediately, but the Native Americans were covered in copper ornaments, and I think that a people who were in possession of a society which could use metallurgy, they could appreciate that copper and say, well, we don't have that kind of copper deposits back in Britain, and I think that's how they hooked up with it.
Yep, I like that explanation. I like that explanation a lot. It was prolific, laying on the ground, easy to get, a good trade item. It would have made its way to the coast and would have caught somebody's attention, especially an industrial entrepreneur. Now,
you bet.
How many men do you think it would take with the tools of those days to mine that much copper? And you're talking about, what, a 2,000-year period?
We're talking about a period from 5,000 years ago to 3,000 years ago. So yes, it's a long period of time. We do still have actually millions, literally millions of their tools still surviving. These are mostly made out of diorite, which is an extremely hard rock, much harder than the rock which surrounds the copper, and very excellent for working the copper. These are hammerheads, chisels, all kinds of some beautifully made diorite tools, and they still exist there. Some of these diorite axe heads, as they call them, or hammerheads, weigh 40 and 60 pounds apiece, so you couldn't wield them exactly on the end of a handle. And it was found that you would tie rope or sinew around the grooves that were found in these hammer stones, put them on a cradle, and then you would use it to bash the rock face to get at the copper. It's a tremendous enterprise. How many people were involved in this? That is, archaeologists among themselves have been wondering about that for a long time. The pit mines that exist today, to give you an idea, to put you in that direction, the pit mines that exist today are they're so numerous that if you took them all in a line, they would form a trench something like 15 miles long, averaging 30 feet deep. How to have created such an excavation like this, how many men would be involved, it's very difficult to tell.
Well, you know, something about industrial sociology, it takes approximately 6 people to support each laborer in this kind of
yes.
operation. There are tools to make, clothing to make, food to make, shelter,
yep.
and then there are transportation labors to consider, not to mention management and staff. So if that many miners were required, let's say there were 10,000 miners, which is probably conservative, you
mm-hmm.
multiply that by 6, and now you've got a rather large population, 60 or 70,000 people. Where did they live?
Not only that, what makes it even more difficult is that you have a very brief mining season. Now, we're dealing with the Upper Great Lakes region where winters set in early and hard, and they last a long time. So you have to go in there, you have to mine that copper as quickly as possible and get it out before the weather closes in. So you only really have maybe 4 months on the outside to get in there and do all of your work. Some of the stories that are still preserved amongst the Menominee Indians who live in that area tell about what they call the marine men or the sea people. They describe them as fair-haired people who came in great canoes, and they wounded Mother Earth. This is their lodge rhetoric. They said they wounded Mother Earth by digging out her shiny bones. These are all metaphors.
Wow.
Copper that took place. And they said that they had a stone, a special stone called a weepy stone, W-I-T-I, a weepy stone, and that these sea people, marine men, would use the weepy stone. They'd go along where they thought the copper might be, and they'd throw this stone on the rock on the ground. And if it made a special noise, if it sang in a special way, they knew that is where the copper was. Now that's interesting because there's something called the bell stone that was used by the Vikings and by people before them, that would resonate if you threw it hard enough in an area where there was metal, not too far from the surface. So it's called a bell stone. You can look it up on the internet. It'll explain that. It's the same thing. Now, the Native Americans, the Menominee Indians, knew nothing about bell stones because they were not copper miners. But they're reporting a legitimate tradition. And they say that eventually they got a number of the Native American Indians to help them to excavate. Here's part of your workforce. To help them excavate the copper. So it's a wonderful story. It's all laid out there, but it's never discussed except amongst heretics like ourselves.
Well, I just, you know, how do you cover up, you know, what would be considered in those days to be a major city? You know, copper mining operations are big labor. Copper's very heavy. It's very dense. It takes, you know, special wheelbarrows to move it. There must have been copper barges that they floated out of that place.
Yep.
And I know that, I guess this is up along one of the major lakes, and somehow you have to make your way to the ocean.
Those Lake Superior.
They're not always, you know, nice, smooth, docile bodies of water. They get a little wind on them, and they get some pretty high waves. Where are the barges of copper that are upside down on the bottom of that lake?
Well, that bottom of that, you're 100% right. The mariners, and they had to be not only copper miners, but great mariners, they had to sail in one of the most dangerous bodies of water on Earth, and that's Lake Superior. They have some of the most ferocious storms. I've talked to sailors that said that Lake Superior is far more dangerous than the North Atlantic in wintertime. And where are those barges? Where are those great ships that you could not put all of that copper into birch bark canoes? That's for sure. You had to have ships. They're at the bottom of Lake Superior, but nobody has done any excavation in that area. There's been none. There's been no archaeological interest in that area at all, except the mines, to the credit of the archaeologists, at least in their own papers, have done a very thorough job in investigating the copper mining enterprise, this great enterprise that took place, especially at Isle Royale. That was where most of the copper mining was focused. And archaeologists in the 19th century also did a tremendous job of collecting this material. But it's never taught in schools, and the archaeologists have never conducted underwater searches there. And one reason why is it's dangerous, and it's cold, and it's they just don't have funding for it. Yeah, but I mean, you have mentioned one of the dreams that I have always had, and that would be to mount a serious underwater expedition around Isle Royale. I bet you dollars to donuts that you're going to find at least one. I mean, if they were using Isle Royale from 5,000 BC to 3,000 BC, they definitely lost ships. And there's definitely one down. There's a Bronze Age ship, I bet, at the bottom of Lake Superior by Isle Royale. And it'd be perfectly preserved because the water is so cold.
Right, and copper is one of the easiest metals to find in water.
Well, should be. It should be. But it has not happened. Nobody has gone there. It's never been investigated, and it needs to be. Should be. Yeah, it should be done.
The most interesting thing to me, and I'm looking at this from an anthropological, you know, point of view, when we have industries like this, and we have them from time to time in our own country, they dry up and they go away. But the structures stay behind, and the people fall in love with the land, and cities go on with other kinds of labor. And, you know, this is the most fertile farmland on Earth, so why do you think the people and all their evidence vanished? They didn't stay behind. And we're talking about generations after generations, families that had to be moved here in order to work this mine for 20 centuries. There is evidence of civilization like that.
Well, the physical evidence is profuse. I mean, the mines are still there. The tools by the millions are still there. Many of the machines are still there. So there's no doubt about that. And why it ended, It ended, we know exactly when the copper mining stopped because of all the stratigraphy involved. The dating is very clear. You don't even need carbon dating. Because we're able to, and it ended abruptly 1,200 years before Christ, 1200 BC. Now that's a really interesting time. Because in 1200 BC, that is just when the Bronze Age ended abruptly in Western Europe. And we had one of those dark ages I was talking about. Between 1200 BC and 700, or rather 800 BC, civilization almost went out. There was a hideous dark age. All of the great achievements of the Bronze Age were lost. Civilization had to start over with classical Greece about 800 BC, the age of Homer. Between 1200 BC and 800 BC, things were in utter chaos. Now, there's a lot of reasons for that, and we can't get into that. One of the reasons why was because there was a major ecological shift that took place on Earth. This is, again, not theoretical. We know that this took place. And that explains why this copper mining stopped, because the Bronze Age dried up suddenly in Western Europe. Some people say, oh, well, they got the use of iron at that time, and that's substituted bronze. That's true to an extent, but not to the vast extent that ruined the Bronze Age. So there are these very, very close parallel between what happened in Europe between 5,000 and 3,000 years ago, and almost exactly, you can use it as a template, between what happened in Western Europe and what happened in North America and the Great Lakes area in that exact same time frame.
Well, it sounds like whatever government commissioned industry commissioned the mining of the copper in Michigan, they were very good at controlling their people, because, you know, a few thousand years later, some colonists came to this country to feed Western Europe with goods and raw materials and things from this part of the world, and they ended up declaring their independence.
Yeah.
So, obviously that didn't happen back in this copper age, and the genetics that would have come over here from Western Europe didn't stay behind. We just have the Native American peoples in that area. There are a few households here and there. All right, fill me in.
Wrong. They did leave their genetic trace. The last article that we published in Unearthing Ancient America is the nail in the coffin of the whole idea that Columbus discovered America. For the past 5 years, anthropologists have been conducting a very thorough DNA study of all the Native American tribes in the continental United States and in Canada. And when this survey was completed, just in time for our book, luckily, they found some interesting things. First of all, the archaeologists were jubilant. They said, oh yeah, this confirms the DNA evidence shows that most Native Americans, the vast majority of Native Americans, crossed the land bridge from Siberia into Alaska about 13,000 years ago. We've been saying that all along. However, the DNA survey that established that as being correct also showed massive influence, DNA influence, part of the Native American, the Algonquian tribes from Western Europe, specifically Normandy in France, specifically Southern Britain and Ireland, and that this influx of a large populations began about 3000 BC on the east coast of the United States, and that these people left their genetic trace behind. Other influences from Japan even earlier were left behind in the Zuni Indians. The Zuni Indians have Japanese DNA that goes back a very long time ago. We're talking like 15,000 years ago. The DNA study is complete. However, not all the information has been released so far. There are other impacts made from North Africa. We're talking about the genetic traces in Native American tribes today. And that these genetic traces actually are complement what the Native Americans have been telling us from the beginning, that yes, there have been foreigners who came here, and we got along with some, and we fought others, they tell us. And that story of the marine men or the sea people that the Menominee talk about are reflected now in the genetic surveys that have been conducted of the Menominee, by the way. So what happened to these people were, these great copper miners, when they came over here, is that they got in fights with the Native Americans. A lot of them were wiped out, and those that survived were absorbed. They intermarried into the tribes and left their genetic fingerprints. That's what happened.
How about that? Yep. That's amazing. You know, just to before we finish the first hour, one of the things I found fascinating in that chapter on genetics was the link between Tibet and Hawaii.
That was
fascinating. I've been to both places. What
that probably means
I didn't
is
see
not
the correlation to your chapter.
Well, there's no problem with that at all. It's a different part of the same prehistory that shows that people traveled extreme distances. Mainstream archaeologists regard the oceans of the world as barriers forever allowing any kind of contact amongst ancient peoples. In fact, we regard the oceans of the world as great highways that connected people. A people that could create something like the Great Pyramid of Egypt, a building that cannot be reproduced today for all its magnificence, would certainly be able technologically to build a ship big enough and capable enough to carry them across the ocean. The connection between the Tibetans and the Hawaiians is really interesting because it doesn't mean that the Tibetans sailed to Hawaii, or it doesn't even mean that the Hawaiians sailed to Tibet. Rather, that both of these people took their lineage from somebody in between. That there was a lost civilization which contributed to both the Tibetans and the Hawaiians. And then you...
Exactly.
You hear stories about the lost continent of Mu and places like Lemuria and so on, and that when a civilization like Mu or Lemuria perished, was subsumed by the sea, its survivors went both east and west, making their genetic contacts with both people, and that's how they have this shared commonality between Tibet and Hawaii.
You know, it's so interesting when you meet the two peoples, the Hawaiians and the Tibetans. You see similarities in their eyes and their body structure, but mm-hmm. you also see similarities in some of their ancient religious symbols and their dress and their choice of colors.
It's remarkable. Both these peoples, the Tibetans and the Hawaiians, you can't imagine two people more far removed from each other geographically and culturally. But when you do begin to examine them, you see some very remarkable commonalities. One of the most remarkable is that they both, the ancient Hawaiians, the pre-Christian or pre-modern Hawaiians, and the pre-modern Tibetans, both have stories of a great flood that destroyed their former homeland. It's remarkable. The ancient Hawaiians repeated the story of a place called Kahiki. And Kahiki was this great island in which their ancestors lived. It was overwhelmed by a natural catastrophe, they say, and that most of them survived what they refer to as a great warrior wave, a kind of tsunami that overwhelmed Kahiki, and that their ancestors voyaged to Hawaii. On the other side of the world, in Tibet, you have the exact same story. They have included on the Tibetan flag, you may have seen the Tibetan flag, a rising sun with various colored rays coming out of it. One of those rays is a white ray. That white ray is associated with the earliest ancestors of the Tibetans. They're referred to as the Mu. Literally, they refer to them as the Mu. And their story is that there was a culture bearer, a culture hero. His name was Miwaki, M-I-W-O-C-H-E. And Miwaki traveled from this lost, sunken island kingdom in the Pacific, and he brought the basics for the high religion of the Bon religion to Tibet, and that this is their story. And in between, you have this sort of a common denominator of a lost civilization. It's very fascinating, and now it's confirmed by the genetic relationship between both the Tibetans and the Hawaiians.
Well, that is so interesting, and it's one of the things to point out is during a flood that made, you know, much of the earth underwater for up to 7 months, it would make sense that a people would migrate to higher ground. And if you've ever been to Tibet, you know, the capital city Lhasa's at 11,000 feet.
Yeah.
And much of the country is above the tree line. What better place to settle than an area that, you know, of course, has plenty of fresh water in the mountains from the glaciers, but certainly is immune to any kind of global flood?
Well, if you are associated with a people who have gone through the unthinkable trauma of having your high civilization destroyed by a natural catastrophe, and you survive this, it's only natural for human beings, human survivors of such a unthinkable catastrophe, to seek the highest ground possible. Not only that, but of course, Hawaii is the tallest mountain on Earth, from its base at the bottom of the sea to its top. It's another example of people striving for heights to get above this terrible event that took place.
Exactly. Exactly right. And that's what you see. And basically, the Tibetans, at least Tibetan Buddhism, has its roots only going back to about the 7th century. It's not really that ancient of a civilization. It took them several hundred years to become organized, and it was only after conquering neighboring nations that they adopted what King Gampo organized as Tibetan Buddhism, which is what they go by today.
I would say that is true as far as that goes. That certainly you've encapsulated very clearly the sort of relatively modern history of Tibet. But Tibetan roots go back much, much further. Before Buddhism before Buddhism was introduced, they believed in a religion, a cult, a shamanistic cult called Bön. Some had pronounced Bon religion or Bone religion. And that religion goes back into deep prehistory. It's associated with this fellow Miwaki I told you, who is this flood survivor who brought the principles of the Bön religion into Tibet. Now, we have an article in Unearthing Ancient America, which we're very privileged to have published. It was an interview that we had with Professor Masakai Kimura of Japan. He is one of the world-class geologists. And for 5 years, he and his students studied this underwater ruin that was found off of a little island called Yonaguni in the Japanese island chain called the Ryukyus. And this ruin, and that's exactly what it is, has been described by Professor Kimura as a kind of a citadel or castle. Definitely, he says, a man-made structure. And he outlines his reasons why he believes that is an authentic ruin that goes back, he thinks, as long as 10,000 years ago. And
that makes a lot of sense. Frank, before we get into a lot of detail on that, let's go ahead and take a 3-minute break right now and let people take a refrigerator break, and we'll take an audio break because we break the show into 3 parts. And then we'll come back in about 2.5 minutes. So we'll take a break right now, and we'll be back with more. Frank Joseph, with X Squared Radio. welcome back to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from central Idaho. It's a winter storm dumping snow in the middle of the valley. And hope that you're nice and snug and have all your Christmas shopping done. You'll notice we're not running commercials during this season. We feel that you get enough commercials. And if you want to buy something, you'll go to our website at x2-radio.com and pick it up for yourself. We're trying not to be so commercial during this season of the year. Did want to let you know that this weekend, a long-awaited, long-hyped movie, a remake of The Day the Earth Stood Still, opened in 90 box offices around the world, doing quite well for its first weekend out, although critics are saying no competition, no real blockbuster movies came out this weekend since 7 Pounds was delayed coming out, giving The Day the Earth Stood Still basically its own weekend to launch. So good for the people that produced that. Reviews are kind of mixed. The over 25 crowd is saying, you know, we kind of like the black and white one better. The under 25, of course, liking the special effects and the fact that Keanu Reeves is in it, is probably doing pretty well. Anyway, a good plethora of good movies coming out, so keep yourself close to the entertainment industry. If you do so, those of us that are trying to explore the planet and probably do better at finding funding to help our expeditions around the world, if you know what I mean. My guest tonight is Frank Joseph. He is the author of Unearthing Ancient America, The Lost Sagas, Conquerors, Castaways, and Scoundrels. And we appreciate him coming on tonight. Frank, how are you doing?
I'm just doing great. It's having a ball out here.
All right. Well, before we start this hour, I want to make sure everyone knows that all of our phone lines are open. The numbers are posted both at VBS Radio Network and also at x2-radio.com. Frank, how do people get your book? What's the best way for you?
Well, I understand that it's available at Barnes & Noble and Borders stores. If they don't want to go out in this cold weather, they can go to Amazon.com. It's also available there. Just plug in the title, Unearthing Ancient America, and they can get it that way. Or they can also get it from our website. We have a website for our magazine. It's www.ancientamerican.com, all lowercase, one word, and the book's for sale there as well.
Now, Frank, you've been the editor-in-chief of Ancient American Magazine. How I want to encourage people to subscribe to the magazine, but what normally is your monthly content, or how often do you come out with that?
Well, we are producing a bi-monthly. It's four-color. It's a very eclectic. We also cover very broad areas. We talk not only about news like Egyptians in America, but we also talk about the early Christians who made it here about 400 or 500 A.D. There's a lot of evidence to show that there were Christian communities flourishing that long ago in Michigan and in Connecticut. All kinds of artifacts that are found by either professional archaeologists or just ordinary people, like farmers, are always finding interesting things in their fields. And until our magazine came along, nobody covered these things. And as far as I know, we're still the only one out there on a regular basis that showcases these finds. And we like to leave it up really to readers to determine if this material is authentic enough or this is questionable. And some of it is questionable, but it's a dialogue. I'd best describe Ancient American as being a free forum magazine in which the evidence is presented for a debate.
Well, I would encourage the listeners to go ahead and subscribe to the magazine, because in reading this book, I've discovered that some of the more interesting discoveries have been made in the last 10 or 15 years. So this isn't stuff that was, you know, discovered after World War I or after the Civil War. You know, we have heavy snowfalls, winds, we have rivers that flood all the time, we have avalanches that happen. We have volcanoes and earthquakes that occur, unearthing all kinds of things. And you farmers out there that are scarifying half the nation, you're digging up, you're turning over soil with your plows and your discs every year. Take some time, walk those fields and see what is in the soil of your areas. You people in the Pacific Northwest, some of the most ancient soil on the planet is exposed there due to the floods that occurred from Missoula, Montana, and raced across the ground toward the sea. You've got soil laying on top of basalt that is probably 20 million years old. So you've got access to some of the oldest ground on planet Earth, and it would behoove you to get out there in your four-wheelers or your snowmobiles and walk this area, explore your planet, see what you can find, and then contact Ancient American Magazine if you find something. It's worth it.
Well, that's exactly, I'm very grateful for you for mentioning that, because some of the more tremendous finds that have been made just, as you say, by people who live in that area or farm it, and they've sent photographs to us, and we've published it. One of the most remarkable things was found in the state of Washington. It was a little statue, very small, of a looks like a kind of a dancing bear. It's very bizarre. It's made out of bronze, and the little bear is holding in either hand a couple of spheres or spherical objects. And on the base of this little statue, there's an inscription in Japanese. And when work was done on this, it was determined that this little bear was part of a cult, a bear cult from Japan that went extinct about 400 years ago. And unfortunately, we don't know the context of its find. It seems highly unlikely that it's a fake or somebody bought modern Japan and dropped there. And it seems to indicate that someone from Japan had arrived on the shores of the state of Washington at least until 400 years ago.
Very interesting. Well, you know, a lot of this stuff is very small. Let's talk about this strange medallion that was found at the edge of Lake Superior by an engineer digging a foundation. What was so amazing about this?
Well, it's incredible because when it was found, just as you say, this engineer found the thing at some depth. It's a little medallion. It's a beautiful little thing. It's in great shape. And on one side, it shows a heart inside a kind of a wishbone, and it's surrounded by a very old Hindu inscription, very, very ancient script. It's so ancient that only a few nuances of meaning have come out of it. On the other side, though, it shows this beautiful temple. On either side of the temple, there are palm trees, and in the center of the temple, there is a typical Buddha figure. And before the Buddha figure, there looks like a large crowd. Now, what's interesting about this is that when this medallion was first shown to some students in the class of Professor James Shears, he's an anthropology professor at the university, or was, he's professor emeritus now, at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. He showed it to some of his students who were from India, and they thought that it might represent the temple in Borobudur in Java. It since turns out, the article is able to show, that in fact the temple represented is called the Tolonan Temple, which is in the north of northeastern India, and that this medallion was issued as a commemorative piece to help raise money for the construction of this great temple, a Tolonan, and it goes back to 1300 AD. That's when this temple was finally created. So here we have found a medallion commemorating the construction of this temple in northeastern India going back to 1300 AD, nearly 200 years before Columbus landed in his part of the New World.
And I think that would mean that the person that was given this medallion was probably of fairly high financial stature, because it probably took a financial donation to this temple to get such a commemorative medallion, and then would have had to sail to America, not the coast, but on the edge of Lake Superior, and then lose it right there.
Well,
it doesn't
appear so much it's a donor. If you look at the photograph, at the very top of the little medallion, there's a perforation, a little hole that would indicate that it was used as a necklace. These medallions were not issued so much to the donors, as it turns out, who contributed to the financial construction of these temples, like the Tolonan Temple that's pictured on the side of this medallion. They were rather given as tokens to Buddhist missionaries who were able to spread the word, as it were. And the Buddhist missionaries traveled extremely far. There's a wonderful book called Pale Ink that came out, must be 30 years ago now or more, which showed a tremendous impact that Buddhist missionaries made in the southwest part of the United States, by Henrietta Mertz. It's a wonderful book, very persuasive evidence, and that this little token found in Michigan is really part of this missionizing effort that was undertaken by Buddhist cults. The Native Americans also talk about these holy men that would arrive and that would talk about mostly the concepts of compassion, which, of course, is the keynote, the core meaning of Buddhism.
Is there any record of the Indians in that area, in the Midwest or Upper Midwest, ever learning and perhaps following the teachings of Buddha?
Yes, most definitely. They didn't refer to him as Buddha. Of course, Buddha just means the enlightened one. The name Buddha also refers to the shining one or the luminous one, self-luminous one. The Native Americans worshipped a figure they called East Star Man. And he also is portrayed as a luminous holy man who wandered all across what became the continental United States, spreading the word of peace amongst the warring tribes. So some people have seen in East Star Man a kind of a Native American version of the Buddha.
Wow. Now, was there another name for Buddha that stuck? I understand when Catholic missionaries came here and asked the Apapskan Indians of Canada who they worshipped, what did they say?
Well, they said also something to the effect that there were these holy men who traveled over great distances on foot, and that they were so well respected that the tribes didn't give them a hard time, and that eventually that these people would stay here permanently, and they just died of old age. They were also told that these people never took women with them, that they never had a family, that they had dedicated themselves to celibacy. Some people have understood this to be early Christians, but more likely it sounds like these are early Buddhist missionaries. It's an interesting thing, aside there, I visited a place called Fire Canyon. This was in Arizona, in the southwest part of Arizona some years ago. And Fire Canyon has a wonderful collection of petroglyphs all over the sides of their walls, or canyon walls. This one petroglyph looked very Asian to me, and I remember I photographed it. I didn't recognize it, but it looked very Asian. I was on my way to Japan, as it turns out, at that time, and I met a fella. His name is Professor Nobuhiro Yoshida. He is head of the Japanese Petroglyph Society. And I showed him this petroglyph. I told him nothing about it at all. And I said, well, what does this look like anything to you at all? And he says, oh yeah, that's the old Chinese kanji, no, this is Japanese kanji rather, for God. And he said, boy, yeah, we see that all over. And I said, well, this is in Arizona. This is in Fire Canyon, Arizona. And he said, oh, well, there's no doubt that somebody wrote that there. And it's obviously a very old glyph, too. It wasn't made yesterday. So it's the old kanji. Kanji is a Japanese form of Chinese writing. And he said that this glyph represented the deity or God.
That's interesting to find that. What's amazing to me, and I know we're probably just about halfway through with the program, is the plethora. I mean, just an overwhelming variety of ancient evidence that explorers, miners, religious teachers came here to this continent hundreds, perhaps thousands of years before Columbus, and we're talking hard evidence, not some nursery rhyme from Europe,
right?
That these civilizations were here, they conducted operations, they left behind hard evidence, and it just is baffling to me that the history books in the public schools don't pick this up and start teaching the truth so that we can become even more enlightened about the real roots of this country.
Well, the thing is, it's not even just being more enlightened. This is our legacy. This is our heritage. And that's not only Native Americans as part of their heritage, too. Everybody that's lived on this continent, we're utterly cut off from it. I think it's a tremendous crime that's been committed. But when you talk to archaeologists, professional trained, university trained archaeologists, they're not even interested in these things. There's no interest. And whenever you show them these objects, they immediately dismiss them as fakes. They never investigate them. And whenever they do write about them, which is rare, their articles are replete with errors and misconceptions that don't even describe these things properly. There just is no interest in the mainstream community because they are brought up and taught on the idea that no one was here before Columbus, that is a line in the sand, and that anything argued before Columbus is ipso facto a fake and of no value. And that's why I think that this system is cracking up. And that it hasn't got, I don't believe that it has got that long to last. The latest DNA evidence that we talked about earlier has so completely smashed this old paradigm that I'm very confident that the way that history is taught now in the schools is not the way that it's going to be taught in the next 20 years. But I think that that these things we're talking about now that are so cutting edge today are going to be thoroughly accepted and taught as mainstream in the future.
Well, that's what we are. We're the cutting edge, slicing ignorance in two to let the light shine through. One of the things I find fascinating as I travel around the world, everywhere I go, I see very detailed depictions of creation. The other theme that I see almost everywhere is the depiction of solar eclipses and a great flood. What was found in the Michigan area that mentions these astronomical events?
Oh, that's a tremendous find that was made over a very long time. You know, even discussing these things kind of angers me because, again, archaeologists have known about this for a long time. This is nothing new, but it sounds new to us because it's been suppressed for so long. Beginning in the early 19th century, the early 1800s, when the very first pioneers were crossing the state of Michigan, they found, as they found in many other states, large numbers of Indian mounds, burial mounds. But the mounds that were found in Michigan were completely different than any other mound collection. There were hundreds of them, maybe thousands of them, maybe thousands of these mounds. And when they were broken into, and they were broken into because sometimes these pioneers thought there might be treasures inside. There never were, no gold. But mostly they were cleared to make way for farmland. But when these mounds, very few of which exist today, maybe a couple dozen, originally there were hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands, but when they were cleared, a large number of these mounds revealed these slate tablets. And on these tablets were a written language, a cuneiform language. And there were illustrations, mostly of a biblical nature, but also calendars. And they found hundreds of these slates, hundreds of them. And they were... They're all across the state of Michigan. And they were, the earliest ones were found in the 1840s, and the last ones were found in the first part of the 20th century. I think the last one was found about 1911, 1909, something like that, when the last bit of Michigan territory was cleared. So there were hundreds and hundreds of these slate tablets. When they were shown to archaeologists, they were immediately dismissed as fakes, that the farmers were just trying to make the archaeologists look bad and so forth. But then a number of these mounds that were excavated were done so under conditions where there were eyewitnesses. They signed affidavits. There were a number of cases where there were lawyers and judges present saying, yes, this information was, these tablets were taken straight out of the ground. They were not buried ahead of time. So the authenticity of these things is really beyond question. And one of these slate tablets was studied by a very brilliant man. His name was David Allen Deal. Lived out in Arizona. He passed away just a few months ago, unfortunately. I believe he's about 70 or so. And David Allen Deal was a specialist in determining the authenticity of artifacts. And one way that he would determine the authenticity of an artifact would be its internal evidence. So he was given this one Michigan tablet that purported to show a kind of a calendar. It looked like a calendar. It was circular. It was broken into 13 sections, which was the way that the old calendars were made according to lunar considerations. And he found that this particular calendar stone dated an eclipse that I believe was I don't remember the year offhand. Gosh, I don't remember the year offhand. Maybe I'd have to look it up again, but the eclipse that was dated.
I think it was like 352 AD or something like that.
That's it. Yeah, that was it. 352 AD. It seems highly unlikely that some hoaxer would have gone to the trouble of creating a mathematical, artwork here that would date that. So then, he thought, well, let's see if there really was a solar eclipse at that time. He then took the information off the Michigan tablet and found out through his colleagues at an observatory somewhere. I don't have that here. It's in the book. And that, in fact, there was a solar eclipse that did take place specifically at that time indicated on this tablet. These tablets belonged to an early Christian community. They were known as the Copts, C-O-P-T-S. They still exist today. They were a Christian community that came into conflict with mainstream Roman Catholicism. They were considered heretics, like the Arian heresy, and they were violently suppressed. One of the reasons that got them in trouble was because they believed that they should conduct their mass in Egyptian, that they didn't want to conduct their mass in Latin. That was enough, of course, to get them burned alive at the stake. So a number of them left. They disappeared. They took off from Egypt. They were headquartered in northern Egypt, in Cairo mostly. And that this community appears to have resurfaced in Michigan. The slate tablets that have been taken out of the Indian mounds all conform to Coptic Gnostic Christianity with its emphasis on solar cycles, such as this calendar. And you find that amongst the Coptic Christians today. There's a strong emphasis on eclipses and solstices and things like that.
Mm. Now, this particular disc, now, I think originally you only had a photograph of it or a Xerox copy of it, and then it turned up disappearing. And didn't they find another one like it in Morristown, Tennessee, of all places?
Right, yeah. There have been a number of these ancient calendars that have been found throughout the American Midwest. Most of them concentrated in Michigan, as I say, but another one was found in Tennessee, which was very close to this event. So apparently this eclipse that took place in 352 AD was of enough religious significance for these early Christians who came to America to note it on their slate tablets and then to include it in these burial mounds.
Find this stuff. This stuff is completely fascinating. You know, if they taught this stuff when I was learning early American history, I probably would have majored in history. To me, the story of Columbus and, you know, getting funded by Ferdinand and Isabella and coming over here and trading in spice, blah, 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 blah. Who wanted to hear that stuff?
Right.
This stuff's really interesting.
Well, it is. I think some of the most exciting things really should be taught because it would, just exactly as you say, it would engage young people in the story of their own roots. One of the more dramatic stories has also been confirmed under unimpeachable situation, and that is the runestone, the Viking runestone that was found in Minnesota, right in the state that I'm talking to you from now. It was about maybe about 4 hours' drive from where I am on the Mississippi. And this runestone was found in 1898, and it's covered on three sides with an ancient runic text, which is not that ancient, actually. It goes back to 321 A.D. And this text that has been verified by Scott Walter, he is a university-trained credentialed geologist. And Scott Walter was able to apply this Kensington runestone, as it's called, to an electron microscope. And the electron microscope showed conclusively that the inscription was made sometime in the early 14th century A.D. with pre-modern tools. This is geologic evidence now. This is not theory or somebody interpreting it. This is the hard evidence. And the story that is on this runestone is utterly fascinating. A tremendous adventure would make a fabulous movie. It tells about how in the year 1320 or 1319, a group of Swedish seafarers were commissioned by the king of Sweden. His name was Magnus. And Magnus commissioned this group of seafarers to find a land that the royal family could settle in outside of Europe, because Europe was being ravaged by the Black Death, and that people were dying by the millions across Western Europe. He needed to find a place where he could take his family away from this terrible disease condition, this epidemic that was sweeping Western Europe. And that is the reason why they sailed across the North Atlantic. When they finally got to the Great Lakes, they came into a conflict with Native Americans. The stone relates how some of the Swedes were killed by the Native Americans in a skirmish that took place, and that this stone was set up as a memorial to those who had perished. And the stone also tells how the leader of this expedition, his name is not mentioned, is now going back to his ships, and they're going to sail back to Sweden.
Wow! So not only did they bring the stone with them, they also brought the stone, the tools with them,
yes,
to write this,
yes,
memorial.
Yeah.
And they're on this tremendous mission of resettlement, of you know, trying to get away from something they were sure was going to wipe them and their progeny out. And they come to this area, and I guess because of the color of their skin or the sound of their language, they weren't very welcomed, and ended up just about all getting wiped out. And it's all,
well, of course,
stone. Now this the man that found it, I believe his name was Olaf Oman.
Yes.
When he found it, how was he treated? I mean, obviously this thing was authentic. So when he brought it forth, what happened to him?
Well, it was definitely authentic because Olaf Oman was a farmer. His farm was the first modern farm in this area of Minnesota. And when he was clearing the land, there was an old, old tree. It was mostly dead. And when he uprooted the tree, that's where he found this large granite boulder inscribed with the runic writing. It was enveloped in the roots of the tree. So he had to cut the stone out of the roots. Matter of fact, it was found by his six-year-old son, who was out there helping. And that when the stone was exhibited for the first time, everybody thought it was a marvelous work of art. A lot of the text could be read, not all of it, but most of it could be read back then. Then when the archaeologists came to examine it, they said it was an obvious fake, that they accused Oman himself, because Oman happened to be Swedish. They accused him of faking it. And the pressure that built so much on Oman and his family was such that his daughter committed suicide, that Oman himself was felt he was completely ostracized by his community. This is part of the nastiness involved by these archaeologists who call these people liars just because they happen to find material that contradicts the established view of the past. But now that the stone has been subjected to electron microscope investigation, of course it didn't exist back then, its authenticity is beyond question.
But well, I just find this. Yeah, I find it completely fascinating and frustrating at the same time that you would think, you know, the field of archaeology hasn't always been there. It was created in the early 1800s and has kind of developed, I hate to say this, but it's kind of developed like a religion. It has its high priests and it has its guardians and it has its, you know, assassins in the press. And without peer review, you just don't go anywhere in this professional science. So, in my opinion, there should be some kind of oath that a person takes if they become a degreed archaeologist, that they will forever seek the truth. And when the truth is found, they will gladly publish it, even if it means refuting findings that they themselves have previously to be true.
Well, to give you an example of how bad off archaeology is, there is a wonderful rapport with a sister science, and that is astronomy. Today, the rapport between professional astronomers and amateur astronomers is excellent. They work together. The comet Shoemaker-Levy was found by a pair of amateur astronomers, and as a consequence, American astronomy is well advanced into the 21st century. Great strides, great discoveries being made. At the same time, there is absolutely no rapport between professional archaeologists and amateur archaeologists. There is no communication whatsoever, and whenever an amateur archaeologist finds something interesting or asks a question that doesn't conform with the paradigm, they're immediately blocked out. They're not discussed, or they're denigrated as a hoaxer. And as a consequence, archaeology hasn't made any achievements whatsoever. It has nothing to show for itself over the last 100 years.
I couldn't agree with you more. My close associate and co-author went down to a very inaccessible place in the Yucatan, and I'll tell you how inaccessible this place is. It's 3 days by 3 foot wide riverboat with an outboard motor behind to get to it. But she did it, and she was a medical professional and was able to finance her dream of being an archaeologist. And she went down there to look for a specific cave entrance in the area known as Piedras Negras.
Oh, yeah.
So she gets there, and she takes a series of photographs, and her camera puts a date down in the lower right-hand corner. When she gets back, she compares her photographs against those that were published in National Geographic, where they had said that there was a mask on the outside of one of these caves that looks like a dragon, and I'm sorry, like a jaguar, and it does. She discovered, only because her camera automatically orients the photographs, they had published the photograph upside down.
Oh, my. Oh.
Right side up, it looks like a dragon mask, not a jaguar mask, which has a completely different meaning.
Absolutely.
So that's how she really became vindicated as an amateur archaeologist. But, you know, the difference between, yeah, it's exciting. The difference between astronomers and archaeologists is that astronomers heretofore have had to rely upon large government telescopes in order to look deep into space. But the last 25 years, advancements have been made with Schmidt-Cassegrain telescopes, so now amateurs for $3,000 or $4,000 can buy a world class photographic quality telescope that can look deep into space. And so now, even though the government telescopes are all contracted for decades to come, these amateurs can pick a corner of space, orient themselves on it, and photograph it night after night after night, and they can find these anomalies, these minute movements in space. And that's why most of the comets have been discovered by amateurs, because they have the equipment and they have the time. So there has to be a handshake between amateur astronomers and professional astronomers.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Well, there's no such handshake, unfortunately, between the professionals and the amateurs in archaeology. It's interesting, too, that archaeology is not a science. If you go to the university or the college, it's almost invariably listed as one of the humanities, and that's because they do not apply scientific rigor to these archaeological finds. It's mostly just interpreted in the light of what they've been told in the textbooks. And if you disagree with that, if you don't go along and you're part of the establishment, it's the end of your career. And this is not just theorizing. We have an article by Virginia Steen McIntyre, who was a university-trained archaeologist, and when she and her colleagues found evidence of fire making in Mexico that goes back a quarter of a million years ago, she was kicked out. Her tenure was suspended. She is no longer an archaeologist, even though she
had the evidence.
She had the evidence. She and her team for over 10 years examined and re-examined this evidence, which they refused themselves to believe at first was true, but now they became convinced the evidence spoke for itself. Yes, there was some human being making fire north of Mexico City a quarter of a million years ago, and yet this evidence has never been discussed. It's never analyzed by their colleagues. Instead, their colleagues told them to completely disregard everything that they have found and that it couldn't possibly be what you say it is. And she refused to do that, and that was the end of her career. And that's
just one example.
That's the one that just comes to mind. There are numerous others. I just won't waste your time with that, but it's an indication. I'll tell you one more thing on that, and that is in 1945, when a colonel in the station in the Aleutian Islands with the Army Corps of Engineers was building an airstrip. And in the building of this airstrip, his bulldozers uncovered literally thousands of human skulls. And these were obviously very old skulls. So he took a crate full of these skulls, and he did what he thought was the best thing. He sent them to the Smithsonian Institution. And then the Smithsonian Institution wrote back to him, yes, we've received the crates of these skulls, we've examined them, we have been able to identify them, there's no difficulty, they're a very obvious type. And that these skulls, which were excavated on the Aleutian Islands off Alaska, were all Maya Indians. They all came from the Yucatan. They all came from the Yucatan. They came from, how they got, so after World War II, of course he had more things to do than archaeology in 1945, and the war ended, he went back to the Smithsonian, this colonel, and he said, this is a fabulous find, what have you done, since then to verify this report? And they said, we don't know what you're talking about. We don't have any reports about this whatsoever. He says, look, I have the receipt showing, I have the letter from, this director, he's no longer with us, and we don't know where that crate is. It's completely lost or deliberately disposed of. That's another example. There are numerous others of deliberately suppressed or destroyed evidence, which is too contrary to the paradigm.
Well, we're going to cover one that you cover in your book. I read every word in this chapter, and I made notes in the side margins, and my jaw was on the floor the entire time. And we're going to talk about it here in just a little bit. But I was going to say, you know, this is not uncommon that, you know, there are locations on the earth with special energy that are built upon and rebuilt upon.
Right.
For instance, Dendera in Egypt is built upon an ancient Hathor temple. Abydos is built on top of the 10,000-year-old Osirian, not far from the Nag Hammadi in Egypt. Mexico City is said to have at least five other civilizations underneath her streets.
Right.
And I don't know how many Jerusalem has underneath it. So it's clear that there are places on Earth that have special energy that seem to attract especially ancient civilizations that relied very much upon the rhythm of Earth and the rhythm of nature for survival, let alone enlightenment. And
you know,
so
you're,
it wasn't
you're absolutely
that they just,
right.
They didn't want to go out in the middle of nowhere and build. They had to build in a special place. So what have you found that fascinates you about that?
That's a really great point you bring up, because people wonder, well, why did people build the Acropolis here? You know, is it just for economic reasons or trade or whatever? You have to realize that the ancient Greeks followed a type of profession known as a geometer. And a geometer, the Greek word, it means a knower of the earth. And the geometer was kind of like a master of feng shui, as it were. He was a reader. He was a spiritual reader of the environment. The same thing was found here in North America. They were the medicine men or the shamans. Each Native American tribe was led by two men, sometimes a woman, by the way, but mostly two men. There was the chief, who was in charge of all the political and military questions to be solved, and then there was the shaman. And the shaman would say, this is where we have our village site, or this is where we make a mound. And why do we make a mound here at this particular site? It's because I read the environment, and here there is a concentration of earth energy, telluric energy. And by heaping up this mound of earth, we are concentrating the natural forces in the earth, and we are interrelating with them, and this is part of our own spiritual empowerment, as it were. And this is what the Native Americans say. This is how they did it. It's the same process that the ancient Greeks knew in the geometer, the knower of the earth. So these places are concentrations of kind of an energy form that still is not entirely recognized or understood. Sometimes it is seismic energy, by the way. There's a place in Northern California called Pinnacles National Monument, and it's right on the San Andreas Fault. This Pinnacle Monument is a natural formation that's filled with quartz crystal, natural granitic crystal. And it turns out that when the San Andreas Fault acts up, it interfaces with the crystal in such a way that it creates a sort of a piezoelectric effect. Piezoelectricity is where you apply mechanical energy to a crystal and electrical discharge takes place, just like, the old crystal radio sets. And that when you're in the vicinity of a piezoelectric effect, you go through altered states of consciousness. It interfaces with the hippocampus of the human brain. And these holy places where people did experience altered states of consciousness were their holy sites. In Britain, for example, in England, it's been established that every one of the megalithic sites, the hundreds of megalithic sites across Britain, all the way from Cornwall to Aberdeen in Scotland, each one of those megalithic sites were originally built over places of seismic activity. That's very interesting. Stonehenge itself is built over two underground water courses that cross directly beneath it. So somehow the ancients understood the relationship between human spiritual experience and the energies that are produced by the earth itself.
You know, it doesn't just tie only to the earth. Interestingly enough, if you go to Rosslyn Chapel, which is in Rosslyn, Scotland, it said that numerous ley lines cross underneath that chapel. And it's also said that that may have been a place where the Ark of the Covenant and the Holy Grail might have been housed for a while. Not a very big building, but it definitely, definitely attracts some very, very unique energy. And it isn't always tied to the earth. For instance, if you look at the way the pyramids are laid out, and there are about 25 of them in Egypt, they're not laid out to the cardinal points of earth. They're laid out to line up directly with the star Sirius, within one arc second of where it would have been at the time those pyramids were built. That's very, very precise measurement.
Well, Sirius was the most important star for the ancient Egyptians. They called it Soptit, or the we know it as the dog star today. That's because it was associated with not a dog the way we understand it. It was associated with their dog-headed god, who was Anubis. The Greeks called him Anpu. The Greeks called him Anubis. And he was the bringer of civilization. He's called also the Westerner, who brought the emerald tablets that established, that made the difference between human beings as savages and as civilized human beings. Also, the Great Pyramid and the pyramid complex at Giza is aligned, according to Robert Bovall, who's done a lot of work in this, with the constellation Orion, that the three pyramids there reflect the same configuration in the sky overhead. So I agree with you. I'm sure that it's not only the Earth. I think that our ancestors, they worshiped the cosmos, and they wanted the purpose of their religion, if you can call it that, their spirituality is a better word, was to put human beings in accord with the forces of nature, because nature was regarded as the physical manifestation of God's will, and that if you put yourself in accord with nature, you're putting yourself in accord with God's will. That seems to be the basic underlying premise of most of these ancient metaphysical systems.
Well, I couldn't agree more, and it seems that now our modern society, our modern industry, is driven by a consumption and a method of consumption and mining that's not in harmony with the Earth. And the Earth is beginning to react to that. And it seems as though the civilizations upon the Earth are beginning to react to it as well. It isn't in harmony with the life of the human race.
It appears that we've lost our focus. And the purpose of mankind in the past has always been, at least until the fall of the Greco-Roman world, about 400 or 500 A.D., has always been on his spiritual development. And to live in harmony, as we said, with the forces of nature. That's why ancient art is still so appealing to us, because it's so nature-oriented. And that with the triumph of certain religions, the focus was away from man's relationship with nature into man's relationship with some theological concept. And mostly a fear-based concept. And of course, it's a fear-based concept because if you can make people afraid, you can control them. It's really a religion of control, I suppose, more than anything else. But that's kind of far afield from what we're talking about with unearthing ancient America.
No, that's okay, because in that religion of control, there seems to be the high priests called the archaeologists that are making sure that nothing is discovered outside of that that line of thinking. You know, I'm totally fascinated by these ancient discoveries, but the one thing that drives most men insane is gold. It's as if there's some genetic lust for this common metal. One of the most tragic of all treasure hunting stories is that of the money pit. Can you tell us of this story?
There's a little island called Oak Island off the coast of the Atlantic coast of Canada, Nova Scotia, and this strange subterranean feature was found in the late 18th century by a couple of teenagers who found an arrangement of logs that went down several feet, and that when it was further excavated, that this pit went down for quite a few feet. So it was very deep. It was a sophisticated arrangement of internal floodgates and so forth. The so-called money pit has been excavated from that time to this. People have lost their lives in trying to find out what this thing is. Literally hundreds of thousands of dollars have been thrown into it. Maybe that's a good reason why it's called the money pit. Far fewer any wealth has come out, has gone into it primarily. And
people
have wondered what this money pit is. Pardon me?
So what's said to be buried in it? I mean, does it line up with some legend of an ancient treasure or something?
No, nothing. There are no legends at all associated with it. Native Americans know nothing about it. But what is interesting is that when a drill core was sent down through the middle of the money pit, I believe in the 1930s, even Franklin Roosevelt was interested in excavating it one time. He threw some money into the money pit, too. And what they did find on this drill pit is that it broke through a couple of chambers, log chambers, and when they withdrew the drill, they found some parchment on it with some what looked like late medieval or early Renaissance writing on it. And there was little threads of gold that were still attached to the drill bit. And that's all that's ever been found off of this thing. Whatever this money pit is, it's apparently bottomless at this point anyway. It's beautifully engineered. Nobody has any idea who could have done it, but it does appear in this one article that's featured in, this is theoretical now, this is one of the few theoretical pieces we do have, but it's based on logic, I think, is the story that the money pit may have been produced by the people who inhabited Roslyn Chapel that you mentioned, and that's Henry Sinclair. Henry Sinclair was in cahoots with the Templars. The Templars were some of the greatest construction engineers of their time, probably the greatest construction engineers of their time, and if anybody could have made that money pit, it would have been the Templars. Why would they have made a highly sophisticated and very difficult to access money pit on Oak Island across the Atlantic Ocean? Perhaps the Templar treasure is down there. The Templar treasure disappeared when they were proscribed by Philip the Fair, and the Pope back in the 14th century. It's conceivable. You mentioned Roslyn Chapel, too. There's an interesting pillar there. In Roslyn Chapel, Roslyn Chapel was completed, at least this section of Roslyn Chapel was completed about 1400 A.D. And in this one section was completed about 1400 A.D., there's a representation of a saguaro cactus. There are no saguaro cactuses in Scotland or in Europe. It's a form of cactus which is only found in the southwest of the United States. And here it's portrayed on the one of the pillars at Roslyn Chapel. Kind of interesting. Somebody knew about
that. That is very interesting.
Somebody knew about Roslyn Chapel a long time before Columbus ever was born, obviously.
Well, I have some interesting family ties going back to there. Not far from there, about 60 miles from there, is what's known as Loch Na, which is a high lake overlooking an area known today as Agnew Bay. And I guess it was known that in the same age, because Agnew Castle was built in 1319, and then it was it subsequently burned, or part of it burned, and it was rebuilt about 70 years later, but Agnews still live there today, so the Agnews were, and the same markings that are on the outside of Roslyn Chapel are on the outside of Agnew Castle, so it's clear
Interesting.
They were vassals of one another, or protecting one another.
Uh-huh.
And I think, let's see, it's, you know who Robert the Bruce is from Braveheart fame.
Sure.
And he had a son, Edward the Bruce, and Edward the Bruce and Sir Andrew Agnew were best friends, and of course, I'm sure shared children and second cousins over many marriages, and eventually migrated to the Scotia area, and then on down through Canada into the U.S., which is where I come from. So when people ask me if the Templars are real, I have to say, yeah, you know, they're real, but are the legendary stockpiles of wealth real? I don't really know. Nothing was ever found by Philip the Fair.
No, and that, of course, that is the reason why Philip the Fair did what he did against the Templars, was to seize their wealth. He had thoroughly bankrupted the French throne. And he needed their wealth in order to cancel out his debts. And so his persecution of the Templars came to nothing. That Templar fleet, which they had, undoubtedly absconded with that wealth. Where it went, nobody has ever known. And it's conceivable that it's at the bottom of that pit on Oak Island.
Well, maybe some of it. I don't know, the recent movie about Templar wealth, National Treasure, being buried beneath Boston is very typical of the common public belief in the wealth and power this group of men possessed. So it's, you know, anytime something like that shows up, treasure hunters like those who thought the treasure was underneath the money pit, it just drives them crazy. I mean, they'll do anything,
There is harder evidence that Templars did, in fact, make it to North America. I'm referring especially to something called the Guildford Knight. And this is the representation, very faint, of what appears to be a man in armor on the side of a boulder that was found in Massachusetts. And this boulder was well known to the Native Americans. They had nothing to say about it except that it was very old. And even mainstream scholars will tell you that this is not a modern fake, but they are not quite sure what it represents. There have been a number of impressions and work done on the Guildford Knight, as it's called, and the most recent one indicates that this gentleman portrayed on the side of this rock, this great boulder, does bear a striking resemblance to the Templar uniforms at the time. The actually be called Neo-Templars, because this would be after the time of the prescription, the time of Sinclair. So I think it's a good indication. Yeah.
Well, the line survived. I think there's plenty of evidence that says they did come at least to the eastern part of the Canadian continent and made their way down into the U.S. at some time during the 17th century. Frank, we're at the end of our second hour already, just a few minutes. It seems like 60 minutes lasts about five on this program. So we'll take our second break. We have one more hour left. Remember that the phone lines are open, so this third hour, if you've got any questions or have some ancient archaeology you've discovered in your backyard, give us a call, and we'll be back in about 3 minutes after this.
Lost and the sea, blind heart.
And welcome back to X Squared Radio, the final hour of our three-hour program. This is a three-hour program coming to you through the BBS Radio Network and also simulcast on the SteelEye Media Network. And we're coming to you live from central Idaho tonight during a winter storm warning. I did want to let you know, if you're in the mood to buy DVDs, documentary DVDs, the one I can recommend the most is the Horizon Project. It is put out, you can access that by clicking on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio. Episode 1 of the Horizon Project begins with a frightening bang. Newly discovered scientific evidence shows that the world as we know it is about to come to an unexpected end. However, the destructive event coming over the horizon is only the tip of the iceberg. Understanding why presents a picture far greater than you could ever have imagined and offers hope in an unsuspecting world. See the overwhelming scientific evidence previously lost from our ancient past and discover the shocking answers that have been hiding in plain sight. Click on the Horizon Project banner at x2-radio.com. This, I should mention, for 2008 was the most popular DVD documentary, independent documentary, sold. And they went out by the hundreds. And we really appreciate the work done by Intuitive Design and by the Horizon Project team. I should let you know that next month, January 2009, that documentary is going to be refilmed. New evidence has come out, even more amazing than the 2007 version, and you're going to love episode 2 of the Horizon Project even more. So prepare yourself. Go ahead and pick up episode 1 and get ready. Also wanted to let you know the History Channel is making rumblings, interest in the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition. We'll know a little bit more about that later on in the year. Our date is still set for August of 2009. If you're interested in helping out, volunteering, helping with funding, advertising, or even scientific experiments, go to NPIEE.org, NPIEE.org. That stands for North Pole Inner Earth Expedition.org. We are still taking applications. And we are still soliciting abstracts for scientific experiments that might be performed aboard the nuclear-powered icebreaker 15 days above the Arctic Circle. Our guest tonight is Frank Joseph. He is the author of Unearthing Ancient America, The Lost Sagas, Conquerors, Castaways, and Scoundrels. You can pick up the book at Barnes & Noble, Borders, probably Walden Books. If you can't find it there, I'm sure you can find it online at barnesandnoble.com. Welcome back, Frank.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we were talking about Templar discoveries and even airstrips that were excavated in Alaska and finds that have been denied, lost, misunderstood, and I want to cover a couple in this hour. One is the story of the Burroughs Cave. Can you tell us a little bit about this story?
This is one of the most contemporary issues that we're addressing in Unearthing Ancient America. Just in a nutshell, in 1982, a fellow by the name of Russell E. Burroughs was out in southern Illinois in a remote area of the state, outside the little town of Olney. This is not far from the Indiana border. It's maybe 200 miles east of St. Louis. And he literally fell down a hole that he didn't expect to find. And in this hole, apparently part of it gave way. There had been some severe rains immediately before. It opened up into a corridor, a very small corridor. He was able to walk down this corridor. It was maybe about 20 feet below the surface of the ground. It was a man-made corridor, and on either side there were small chambers. And in one of these chambers, he claims to have found not one, but two golden sarcophagi, or golden coffins, and that these golden coffins were embossed with all kinds of carvings, obviously something from another world, it seemed. He couldn't remove these sarcophagi. He wanted to. In the next little chamber, he found literally thousands upon thousands of stone tablets. Many of these stone tablets were also inscribed with the likenesses of people from what appeared to be Roman-era North Africa. He took a number of these stone tablets with their writing on them, some in Hebrew, some in the form of Latin, and others showing profiles, mostly of men and women, mostly men in military uniforms, helmets, and so forth. He took these tablets to the state archaeologist. This is 1982 now. The state archaeologist just dismissed them out of hand as fakes, and that he more or less accused Russell Burroughs of perpetuating a hoax. Burroughs claims he never created any of these objects, and since the state archaeologist showed no interest in them, he brought out what amounted to about 3,000 of these artifacts. 3,000. He claims there are at least another 4,000 in the cave. These artifacts he brought out, he sold and is still selling to various collectors around the world. These objects, I've seen a number of them myself. I've been fortunate enough to handle a number of them and studied by people who are experts in epigraphy, professional historians. I'm thinking especially of Professor Cyclone Covey at from the University of North Carolina. And it's the general conclusion, consensus of most scholars who have looked at these objects seems to indicate that they belonged, in fact, to a Roman colony in North Africa. Today, it's in the area of Morocco, was known then as Mauritania, has no relationship to the modern state of Mauritania. The cave, then, Burroughs continued to remove these stones until in 1988, a new law was passed in the state of Illinois prescribing very severe penalties for anybody who undertakes archaeological investigations without a certification. Burroughs was afraid that he might be prosecuted under this law, and therefore he closed the cave, in his words, by dynamiting it. He set off five black powder explosions at the various entrances to this cave, and no one to this day has been able to access this underground site. However, 10 years ago, in 1998, a ground penetration radar survey of the area reveals the corridors that Burroughs had found in 1982. And from that point on, from the last 10 years now, there's been a consortium of diggers, investigators, and excavators who have tried to access this underground site. And last November, last month, some new ground penetration radar revealed the perfect place to dig. People wonder, why has this taken 10 years to dig into this site? It's extremely fragile. And some of the corridors that have been accessed have been found to be flooded all the way up to the ceiling. Apparently, when Burroughs set off these explosions, he ruptured an underground aquifer, and that this aquifer unfortunately deluged some of these rooms. But this month, what's left of it, a new archaeological team is on site at the cave site right now, and they're in the process of trying to lower a kind of a camera, a television camera, into one of these rooms to see if, in fact, there are the artifacts that Burroughs describes are still there, especially the golden sarcophagus.
Wow!
So,
where is that footage going to be aired? I mean, is this a private expedition? Is this something done by, you know, one of the cable channels, or is it?
It's being conducted by the magazine that I work for, Ancient American. Ancient American
is so fascinating.
Ancient America has worked as an umbrella organization that has pulled in. We have on our side, fortunately, state-certified geologists, several. We have state-certified archaeologists who are willing to break with the mainstream over this. And the progress has been so slow because the site is very, very fragile, and it seems to be coming to a head this month. Depending on weather conditions, if there's a lot of rain down in Olney, which is the town next to the cave site, then we cannot excavate. So we're going to have to wait for some dry conditions. Snow is okay, but it's only if we get too much rain that we can't excavate. So they're hoping that still sometime this month, as a matter of fact, we're hoping we may be able to get in before Christmas. It's possible. If the weather conditions hold off, if they don't, then they'll have to be resumed in January.
Wow! Yeah. This is completely fascinating. You know, there's
well,
this
is the most important. This is the most important object, most important procedure that we've ever been involved in, because it would appear that there is a profusion of physical evidence that would definitely establish an entire colony of people setting themselves up in southern Illinois around the year 41 AD. The reason why we say 41 AD is because the preponderance of the evidence, a preponderance of the stones, seems to indicate a time that was in line with an emperor by the name of Claudius. And Claudius reigned beginning around 41 AD. It was a period of time of chaos in Rome. His predecessor, Caligula, had bankrupted the Roman state, had declared war on this colony in North Africa. The colony had set up an independent state. And that refugees from this colony, Mauritania, some of them may have ventured across the North Atlantic. And it was a mixed group. There were some Hebrews amongst them, some Phoenicians or Carthaginians actually, mostly Romanized North Africans. That's what it appears. And that the state that we're talking about, called Mauritania, was kind of a multiracial, multi-religious estate. And so that's reflected in the artifacts that we've seen from the caves so far. It's a very fascinating enterprise. It's been going on for a very, very long time. But it looks like now it's finally coming to a head. Like I say, they are down there right now excavating or trying to set up their equipment. And hopefully the conditions will be good enough to begin excavating before Christmas this year.
Wow. You know, there's no such thing as coincidences, Frank. I'm gonna just lay a couple out here for you. First, you're on X Squared Radio tonight, and Monday morning when millions of people go back to work, they log in to BBS Radio, they access the archives, and they're going to listen to this episode. I would love, if you guys do make a discovery there, I would love for you to get back a hold of me. We'll put you back on X Squared Radio the instant that it happens, even if it's for 15 minutes or 20 minutes, and we'll make a world announcement that something has been found. And the other coincidence is the company that I work for has just been awarded bonds to begin a new biodiesel plant just east of St. Louis.
Oh, my God.
So it's just... it is amazing that it looks like, well, of course, I'll be heading up that project, but it'll be probably early spring before that breaks ground. But it looks we're going to be in the same neck of the woods there for a little while.
Well, yeah, that's right. Olney is not that far from St. Louis. It's a few hours' drive from St. Louis. But this is a very exciting thing, and, of course, I'd be very happy to share whatever I can with your listeners. My role in this has been kind of like a liaison man. I've only been down to the site once. I did participate in one of the digs. Ancient American has spent upwards of at least $100,000 of its own money going down there and performing the excavation and the investigation. We've rented only the state-of-the-art equipment, and we had to, of course, also pay for its operators. So we know for a fact that there are things down there, but they're very difficult to excavate because the site is very, very fragile. And my job is to be able to make this available to the public. We're not asking for money or anything at all. We're just declaring that this is a great, great discovery, and we sure hope so. I mean... We haven't gotten inside it yet, but it looks like at this point we're very, very close. And it's just fortuitous that I'm on the air with you now, because it's only just now that we're finally seriously getting down to business, hopefully.
That's very fascinating. I can't wait to hear the news. So let's talk about one other very hard to get to, very amazing discovery, probably one of the most amazing discoveries in the 20th century in the United States. And that was known as, it was discovered by a man named G.E. Kincaid. And he was,
yes.
He was exploring by himself in the Grand Canyon. And I guess he'd already been associated with the Smithsonian for a number of decades as a photographer. So tell us what happened with Mr. Kincaid.
Well, G.E. Kincaid was a colleague of Ansel Adams, and that he was one of the great early nature photographers of the first part of the 20th century, that G.E. Kincaid had been engaged by the Smithsonian Institution on several previous expeditions to photograph areas of the Southwest that had not been documented before. And in late 1908, Kincaid was hired by the Smithsonian to make the first photographic record of the Grand Canyon. And in order to do that, he had to travel through areas of the Grand Canyon that had never been seen before. As a matter of fact, he was only the second human being that had ever gone through the Grand Canyon. I mean human being, because Native American Indians shunned at least the northern sections of the Grand Canyon as evil, wicked places that would never go there. With good reason. It was very, very dangerous. So Kincaid set out alone in his boat with his photographic equipment on the Colorado River, doing what he was asked by the Smithsonian to do, to create this photographic record. He was in an extremely obscure area of the Grand Canyon taking his photographs when he was shocked to see, in this area that had never been visited before, a flight of steps carved into the side of the cliff, obviously man-made steps, like a grand staircase. He landed.
Wow, hey Frank.
Yes.
Before we go up the steps, we do have a caller on the line. Caller, your
okay.
First name and where you're calling from, please.
Hi, Dr.
Mark. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I got two quick questions, and I'll listen up to mine, and thank you for being a doctor drinking.
Once. One of them is, does he see any relationship between the suppression of our history and the suppression of information related to UFOs? And could he comment tonight on evidence of giants that have lived in North America? And I will listen.
Offline. We're going to cover giants, Mark. All
right, thanks a lot.
We're going to cover giants, Mark. Thanks for the call.
I'll see you guys later. Bye.
Okay, Mark, thanks. Okay, Frank, take us up the stairs.
Okay, well, so Kincaid was amazed to climb these stairs, quite a long flight, and at the end of the top, he came to the entrance to a cavern, not a cave, but a cavern. He then went back down to his boat, and he returned with a lantern, and he entered this cavern. It branched out into a number of very large corridors. One of the corridors took him to the largest of all the rooms that he entered. This one room he described as a kind of a cafeteria, where there were long benches and seats, everything made out of stone, and provisions for food. He says it was just an enormous, almost an amphitheater. This thing is all inside the mountain now. This is excavated inside. This is an underground
wow.
City in the Grand Canyon. He took another corridor to off the side of this cafeteria-like chamber, to a much smaller chamber. It looked like dormitories of some kind. He investigated other chambers. They included stashes of weapons, bronze weapons, edged weapons. The most remarkable of all that he described in the greatest detail was a chapel. And in this chapel, this rounded room, there was a large altar. Around the base of this altar were about a dozen or so statuettes of demonic little figures. On the altar itself, the dais of this altar, there was a larger-than-life-size representation of some anthropomorphic deity, some kind of a god or goddess. his description isn't as detailed as it should be. It sounds like he's either describing the Egyptian god Bes, which was a dwarf god with his tongue extended, that was the god of joy and happiness, or else a Hindu goddess, Kali, because he does seem to indicate there are several arms involved. Kincaid made a photographic record of all of this. He returned, he continued on with his expedition, he returned to Yuma, and there for the Arizona Gazette, he gave a full interview that was published on the front page of the Arizona Gazette and a number of other contemporary newspapers at that time. No joke, went into all the detail. You can still get a copy of that today. You can get it right from the Arizona Gazette. It still is in circulation. It's a major Southwest newspaper. He contacted the Smithsonian. The Smithsonian launched its own expedition, again with Kincaid at the head. The leader of the Smithsonian expedition, his name was Professor Jordan. Jordan and his crew went back to the cavern. They created a kind of a little railroad, and on this railroad they had railroad carts, and the carts were filled with artifacts, one after another, which they floated up on barges back to Yuma. The cavern site was then closed with a great iron gate and padlocked. And that's it. This is in the year 1909. If you go to this, nothing else was ever heard about, no other coverage in any of the newspapers. Nothing was ever discussed. If you call the Smithsonian today, they'll tell you the same thing they told us. They say, well, we get calls every once in a while about the lost city of the Grand Canyon. We have absolutely no record of anything ever like that ever having taken place. We don't know anything about somebody called Kincaid. We've never heard of anybody called Professor Jordan. So on our own research, we found out that Professor Jordan was in fact an employee of the Smithsonian, and that his last known article for a Smithsonian newsletter was published in 1926. And as far as Kincaid is concerned, I spoke to the great-grandson of G.E. Kincaid, who told me all about how his photographic records were shown to the family for years, and that they have books that were published by the Smithsonian and credited to Kincaid in the early part of the 20th century, before World War I. So the Smithsonian, number one, either has some kind of an amnesia problem, they don't know anything about their own recent history, they've lost all their records, or else they're involved in a deliberate cover-up and they don't care whether anybody knows it or not. Now there was a fellow, this is unverified, but I believe that it's true, there was a fellow who read that article in Ancient American when it came out. He made a point of trying to find that site, and he claims that he did. And he said that when he got there, there was some kind of sensor array involved, and that it set off an alarm when he was there, and he skedaddled out of there. And he said that the steps are there. He climbed the same steps that G.E. Kincaid photographed. He climbed the steps to find the cavern with its great iron door still padlocked, and he found the remains of what appears to be a kind of a little railroad they used to cart the things out. But he was afraid because there were these sensor arrays there. He also encountered signs in the area posted by the park district saying that no one was allowed in that area without special permits. So I don't know if any of that's true, but it appears that it is true. I believe that it's real. I think that the Smithsonian has covered that up, that there's an underground city in the Grand Canyon. It's either Egyptian, or I tend more to think that it's a Hindu civilization that made its way to the Grand Canyon and set itself up there a long time ago. That's also verified by the Native American traditions, who regard it all as a place inhabited by evil spirits. They never go there.
Well, let's talk about, I mean, besides the archaeological value of this, and by the way, I think we should go ahead and get a permit and see if we can't get a key to that padlock and get in there, maybe in the next year or two, and see what we can take pictures of. But I understand that these stairs are about 2,000 feet off of the river, 2,000
feet
below.
That's right.
It doesn't make any sense if the Grand Canyon is as old as geologists say it is. Why would they put the stairs so far above the river? Why wouldn't they make it right down at the base of the river?
You got it. There's no doubt that most of the Grand Canyon was carved out slowly over time because it has all these bends and curves in it that would have taken a long time to do. But there is abundant evidence to show that there were surges. Now, this is something which geologists are coming to recognize, and you can just go on the internet and find out the latest dope on the geology of the Grand Canyon. They do now know now that there were surges of violence in the Grand Canyon that carved out parts of it within a matter of days, not millions of years. Now, most of it was carved out over many millions of years of the Colorado River slowly going down, but there were other instances of major quick changes. I would like to get to the two questions that that fellow asked. I thought they were really
good
questions.
Yeah, let's go ahead and do that. His first question was, do you see any relationship between the suppression of archaeological history and the suppression of UFO evidence?
That's a really excellent parallel. And the reason why is, now, this is just my own personal belief. This has nothing to do with the other writers at Ancient American. I do believe that there has been a consistent cover-up of the UFO phenomena. I think that the evidence there is also overwhelming. And the reason why the authorities keep saying, oh, no, there's nothing has happened, is because they're in a position where they cannot say that, yes, we know the truth now. We cannot say that, we have known all along that there have been contacts with extraterrestrial civilizations, because they'd look like absolute fools or criminals for covering this stuff up for so many decades. And I think that the same thing exists with the archaeologists. They cannot say that, oh, yes, there is a city in the Grand Canyon, and that its stairs are 2,000 feet above the water line, the river line, because they would feel that they'd look like fools all this time, or else deliberately covered up evidence that they should have made known to our great-grandfathers. So there is a real parallel there between the suppression of the truth when it comes to contacts with intelligences from elsewhere and the equal cover-up of our own past.
Well, that's a good answer, and I kind of feel the same way. And I also feel that the general consensus among the population is it's about time to stop acting like fools. We're ready to forgive and forget. Let's at least find out who we were, and then maybe we'll have a clue as to who we are.
Mm. Well, that's kind of important, isn't it? I mean, we're not children. And what was the other question here? About the giants.
He had asked a question about giants, evidence of giants in America.
Oh, that's wonderful. There was a culture called the Adena, A-D-E-N-A, been known to archaeologists for a long time, since the end of the 19th century. And the Adena were the first people that introduced agriculture to North America. This is about 3,000 years ago. The Adena were also iron workers. They had foundries. Their foundries exist all over the Ohio Valley. They began in the Atlantic Northeast, and they eventually migrated into the Ohio Valley, where they established a kind of a state. Now, the Adena also built stone pyramids. Now, they're not like the stone pyramids in Egypt. They're first mounds, beautiful, huge mounds. There's one that was on the Ohio River, not too far inside the West Virginia border. And this great mound was completely covered in cut blocks of stone. So it was a stone pyramid that these people built. Now, the remarkable thing about the Adena, we don't know their real name. The only name that we have that comes down from these people is through their enemies, the Native Americans, who exterminated them. These people lasted for a long time. The Adena set themselves up in the Ohio Valley about 3,000 years before Christ, and they lasted all the way to about 700 A.D. The last of the Adena were destroyed at the Falls of the Ohio, according to Native American tradition. The name Allegheny, which everybody's familiar with, stems from these people. They were known either as the Allegui, or the Alley, or the Alleg, something like that. We don't know, because it's filtered through the Indian culture. But the thing about the Adena that was great is that these people were incredibly tall. There's a mound that was excavated in southern Ohio about 80 years ago, and the mound inside was a burial. It was a tomb. And there were five skeletons. Four of the skeletons were of normal height, and the four skeletons were oriented to the four cardinal directions. However, one skeleton, this is an Adena mound now, one skeleton off to what would have been the southwest represented a man who was, in real life, 7 feet, 1 inch tall. Now, this skeleton was first found. The archaeologists could not believe their eyes, so they thought, oh, this must be disarticulation, that when the body is in the ground, its bones become uniformly separated, and it gives the impression of being taller than he really was. That could not account for the oversized skull, however. And as other Adena mounds were opened, more and more of these skeletons of people who were well over 7 feet tall. They were a robust people. They were not in any kind of metabolical deformity. And as time went on, it was learned that the Adena themselves were an exceptionally tall people, that the women were tall also. Not quite, but you had women who were 6'9", 6'10", very common, and you had men who were well over 7 feet tall. Now, this is not a fringe archaeology. There's a mainstream archaeologist, and you can look him up on the Internet. His name is William Dragoo, D-R-A-G-O-O. And in one of his books, he has a drawing of this early Adena mound, which represents the man who's 7 feet, 1 inch tall. And so there was definitely a race of giants who inhabited North America. They were the early civilizers of North America. They raised a variety of crops. They introduced agriculture. There was no agriculture before them. They were iron workers. And they also built great stone forts. Some of them still exist today. The archaeologists don't call them forts anymore. They call them all observatories, which is utter nonsense. They are military forts. They're hill forts. And these people appear to be very closely related to the Celts of Western Europe. As a matter of fact, they were the Celts of Western Europe. The Celtic people were also known to be seven-footers. They also built log tombs, just like the Adena built in the Ohio Valley. The Celts were also known to be great masters of ironworks. The iron workers of the Adena left their foundries all over the Ohio Valley. So the Adena were, in fact, these Celtic peoples who are represented in the DNA survey that we talked about at the beginning of the program. There they are. And they were a race of giants compared to the native peoples who did not reach that stature, that's for sure. So two very excellent.
So where can we go in the state of Ohio for the Adena Giant Museum that proves ancient Celts lived and flourished in the Ohio Valley and taught agriculture to the locals?
Tell you what, you go to any museum, any established archaeological museum, go to Moundsville, Ohio, for example, and their museum is dedicated mostly to a later culture called the Hopewell, but the archaeologists who run that museum know about the Adena as well. That's like privileged information. You go to them and you say, what about the Adena? They were kind of tall, weren't they? And they're going to have to tell you. They're going to have to tell you, yeah, they were on the robust side. And then you bring along William Dragoo's book, and Dragoo is a highly respected author. I don't know if he's alive anymore. He's one of the doyens of American archaeology. Say, well, how do you explain this skeleton that's over 7 feet tall, according to Dragoo? Are you going to oppose Dragoo and say that he was wrong in this? And look at these log tombs that the Adena built. The Adena built here in the Ohio Valley. They're dead ringers for the log tombs that the Celts built. Oh, then you'll get thrown out, probably. That's going too far. But they can't deny this, see. It's impossible for them to deny it. And what about all these iron foundry works here that we're finding all over the Ohio Valley? And we were told that the Celts were also great masters of iron swords and so on. And then how about the DNA? Well, of course, they'll just ignore you or refund your money and tell you to leave or something like that. they can't deny it. It's the impact made by the Celts on Eastern America is beyond question. The Adena also are described by Native American tribes as being not only tall, but also red-haired, fair-haired, and light-skinned. Interesting, interesting stuff.
That is very interesting indeed. I remember a couple of years ago I was in Mexico City, and they have some of the Aztec and Mayan relics that have been uncovered down there in the central part of Mexico City. And one of the tombs, or I should say it's more like a stone coffin. They have a glass cover over it so those you could see the skeletons that were buried inside there.
Mm-hmm.
The man is 7'4" and weighed, they estimate, 400 pounds. And the legend about this man is that he could run as fast as a horse.
Mm-hmm.
And he could even knock a horse to the ground with his bare hands. So he was obviously a very powerful man.
It's remarkable. There was I wonder if that's the same fellow that that was a later fellow who fought the Spaniards, and he was called the Aztec Goliath. And they don't know his name, but he was an Aztec warrior. He just absolutely towered over the Spaniards. He was even taller than most of the Aztecs, but he was this great warrior who could wrestle horses to the ground. And that's a historic fact. This is not legend now. And he was only overcome by the blunderbusses that were fired by the Spaniards. They had to almost use a cannon on the guy. So he really, there definitely were what we could call giants. I mean, if you see an army of people that are over 7 feet coming at you, you're going to realize this is no ordinary collection of warriors. And that's why the Adena had a very successful culture. It lasted from 1000 B.C. until 700 A.D. That certainly is greater than anything we've achieved so far. And
sure. Well, I just imagine. I think they were probably mostly a defensive people, but, you can imagine it's always the big kid on the block that gets picked on by the groups. So over the centuries, they probably just, were so unlike the Native American surroundings that they just were expunged from the area. But you're right, it did take 2,000 years for them to get rid of them.
It's interesting that the Native American traditions, which are true, the Native I've really come over time to deeply respect the Native American traditions of their own past. Hell, they should know better than any archaeologist what their people lived through. And the Native American traditions describe the Adena, or possibly they were called the Aleg or Alegui, we don't know, the Allegheny, whatever they were really called, as being harsh but very fair. They were very jealous of protecting their lands, but they did allow people to pass through their lands if the people were well behaved and things like that. So they were very law-abiding, law-conscious. But at the same time, they kept themselves separate from everyone else. So it's a fascinating story, and we try to develop it in Unearthing Ancient America as clearly and succinctly as we can. It's a wonderful drama, if nothing else. And it's interesting to make parallels between our time and these other civilizations, which, civilization didn't begin on North America in 1492. Our civilization is only the last of several that have risen and fallen over time. And I think there's there's great lessons to be learned in that, because these civilizations flourished for many centuries. What went wrong? Why are they no longer with us? Why did they collapse all of a sudden? And it's important, I think, for us to understand it, because we are not exempt from these same iron laws of the past. And we need to understand.
Well, you know what they say. Those that do not know history are doomed to repeat it.
Well, some of the lessons are very hard and very politically incorrect. And I think that's one reason why history is hard for people to grasp, because they don't want to believe some of the... They don't want to see their own reflection held up too closely in the mirror of the past, I think.
We've done a good job at removing the mirror, so now we can see clearly into the past and possibly into the future too. Frank, we're completely out of time. The book is called Unearthing Ancient America. My guest tonight has been Frank Joseph. I highly recommend that you subscribe. subscribe to Ancient American Magazine. Look it up on the net, subscribe to it, and stay current, because Frank is at the leading edge of probably one of the most amazing archaeological discoveries in America today. And I mean it's happening this week. So stay current. Subscribe to the magazine. Frank, is there anything you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, just keep an open mind, as I said at the beginning, and I'm very grateful for the opportunity to be able to talk to your listeners, and this one gentleman that called in, I thought had some very insightful questions, and I'm sure that you're reaching a great many people that need to know what the real facts are, the real dope on what's going on.
Well, that's one of the wonderful things about webcast radio. We have 49 networks right now tied into us, and lots of people listening live. But the vast majority of our listeners have a credit card and a PC when they sit down to listen to this archive. And so they're able to take immediate action. And we advise them to do so by picking up your book, Unearthing Ancient America. Frank, it's been an absolute pleasure. Please stay in touch and let us know if there are any developments.
I certainly will. You'll be the first to know.
Thank you very much. Have a wonderful holiday season.
And the very best to you. Happy solstice.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
Well, that's it for X Squared Radio tonight, December 14th, 2008. And we will see you on the 28th of December. We will have an archive on the 21st. Peace to you all, my friends.
It has been our pleasure to have you here this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we try to provide the best 3 hours of talk radio on Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours where you live, send the call letters of your local radio station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, who you are. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe. So try to do it on purpose. Be aware that every life is immensely valuable. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.